Most of that power counting will be for relativistic particles, which is the spirit in which we've been doing things so far. Then when I start talking about non-relativistic particles, I'll only go partway down that road. So the issue there is, if you're at energies below the mass of something, then you're typically not going to start off with, it may be that that heavy thing is still in your problem, because it might be that heavy thing is stable. It might be maybe low energies, what you're talking about atoms or something, or protons. So those are there. They have a lot of energy, but you can't release that energy because you can't decay. So it could be that you have, in your low energy theory, a non-relativistic particle. And then it doesn't make any sense to carry the antiparticle around. Because, or it doesn't, if you're in the sector where you have antiparticles, it doesn't make any sense to carry particles around. Because if you had them, they would annihilate the release energy, so you wouldn't have a low energy theory. Where you'd have to actually be careful that the rate for that was very small. But the main point is that because the antiparticle, if you don't start with particles or antiparticles, you won't get them because you don't have enough energy to produce them. And so so you should be integrating that along with everything else. And what that effectively does is that means that the effect below the mass of the particle is what you would have done if you were running effective theory down in the 30s. It's the fields involved, instead of being summed over modes of some creation operator, construction operator is a mode function plus antiparticle creation operator is some other mode function. You just don't need this term anymore because you don't have any antiparticles around. And so all of the foofera of relativistic field theory goes away, and you're just doing what you were doing in the 30s if people talk to like field theory for electrons that are not relativistic. And so the field theory you're led to is a non-relativistic second quantized theory. And much of what you did in quantum mechanics classes as an undergraduate, you know, reinterpreted in terms of this field theory, including, you know, precision calculations and atoms and stuff like that. But you can repeat the steps involved with power counting in this case, and it's more involved. And it's more involved because there's another low energy scale now, because the energy is typically p squared over 2m. And so it's much, much smaller than the momentum if the momentum is much, much smaller now, which it would be true if you're not really this limit. So this ratio of momentum divided by m for energy divided by p, which is p over 2m, that's essentially the velocity in units we're doing it right in units for p like is 1. So the non-relativistic expansion powers of V over C is a special case of this low energy expansion. But now you have to be careful about thinking about the energy and momentum differently, because they're not scaling together as they would have done for all these particles. So I won't do all the power counting there, but I want to set up the problem for in our QED, which is this for quantum mechanics. So you can see that you can plug right into everything you know and love about quantum mechanics as an undergraduate. But you're really doing it in a controllable approximation right from first principles. And that, I forgot to say, but the main thing is I want to set up that what this thing looks like. Because the last topic would be the effective field theory near the Fermi surface. And there, because of this issue that the energy and the momentum are treated differently, that complicates the story of the near Fermi surface. But it's just in detail. It's the same logic as general as before, where you're looking at low energy. Because there's more than one scale in the problem, it won't be just exponential analysis anymore. It'll be a little more systematic with how we scale things. How we define a low energy limit. But you'll see that all kind of emerges. And the advantage of this NRQD is it's a way to set it up from a place where you actually understand with the simple theory of QED, and you're not trying to understand a condensed matter system, it's just some simple system. So that's the plan of where I want to go. And there's a similar structure of gravity which is kind of being just explored now, where the analog of this NRQD is being worked out for big massive objects that are radiating gravitational radiation. And that's, and that, so it plugs into, it's a more, it's a systematic way of deriving the post-Newtonian expansion. But it tells you how to deal with problems that the people have traditionally had in the post-Newtonian expansion, like divergences that you get at some point. From this point of view, it's just one more renormalization of the effective field theory, which isn't so clear if you're coming at it from a classical perspective. So there's lots there, and there's kind of a lots of direction to go from there. And the main message is that power counting gets more complicated when you're not realistic.
Are we skipping GR as an effective
field? No, that's what I'm going to do right now.
Oh, okay.
But I'm telling you kind of where we're going in the rest of the term. So that, and what I'm not going to do in GR is this non-realistic thing, which is probably the most interesting part of it, since it's, that's the part where the that's where the practical applications are, because in that case, your effective, you know, the big heavy particle I'm talking about here might be a black hole or the Earth or some big macroscopic thing, and they typically are non-realistic. So the real applications are there, and I want you to be aware of the fact that power counting and finding was really easy, but there's a long sonic dance in the literature about power counting, and the sonic dance is about this non-realistic issue. And that complicates everything. This is, I think, the thing that's good about this is in the old days, bound states and relativistic theories are things that people have spent a lot of time trying, a lot of work trying to sort out. I mean, how do you do the hydrogen atom carefully in quantum electrodynamics, for example, or have it on the PCU? And there's a big swamp about the beta Salpeter equation and some infinite classes of graphs, and it's a whole bunch of stuff. And my take on that stuff, and I'm not a specialist, so I might be wrong, but my take on that is that in the end of the day, the basic problem is that when you're doing a bound state, perturbation theory is failing. So you can talk about summing graphs all you like. The problem is that the graphs don't work. And that's because when you just do straightforward perturbation theory with QED, you're organizing your series, your graphical expansion, in terms of finite structure constant, the coupling constant. That's not the important, that's not the right thing to be using as your expansion parameter when you're thinking about these bound states. It's typically true for QED that the bound states are non-relativistic. And in the typical binding energy, you know, they saw the order of alpha, so V in a bound state is of the order of V over C, is of the order of alpha. And so the energies are of the order of 1/2 mg squared is order m alpha squared, which is like the binding energy of atoms. So it's because the coupling is weak that you're in this non-relativist limit, so it's not irrelevant that the coupling is small. But the more efficient way, because V over C is really better thought of as a ratio of energy scales, it's a better way to think about it is to organize your calculation where it's the ratio of energies which is what's suppressing your perturbations. And that organizes your calculation in a non-relativistic way rather than this traditional QED way where you're, which is designed to make things be manifestly covariant and exploit the series of powers of alpha. It just happens that that concept's used in series in the bound state case, even in QED where things are nicely under control. So it's useful to know that you don't ever need to think with the Salpeter equation to do anything useful. You can, you're actually much better off using the things that you learned in as an undergraduate about quantum mechanics and atoms. All right.
Are there examples of relativistic constants?
Yeah, well, K-prons are a big example of that.
Yeah.
Of course, they're like sort of hard. So the main thing there is that so then you can't use these tools. And then you're really stuck because there's not a lot of tools you can use, so that there's not a lot known. But it's a pretty good, most of what you know is kind of the interplay between data and the power of calculations. But it's good to know when perturbation is really not working. Then you have to man up, deal with the system size problem, level problem. But it's kind of the last resort of scoundrel to be summing classes of graphs and not telling you why this class of graphs, this infinite class of graphs is what you're keeping. And another infinite class of graphs, which are the same size, the powers of whatever you thought was small, you're not keeping. Why should that be a good approximation of the system you're really trying to describe? And that's ultimately the problem with these resummation issues. Someone has to justify why this class of graphs is important to this other class of graphs. And you can do that sometimes. But when you can, it's typically true that if you reorganize things in terms of a low energy expansion, that's a much more efficient way to get at what you're trying to do, because that's normally what's controlling the approximation in that case. So the net relativistic stuff is that it's an important thing. So So, short version of the course so far is that being non-normalizable is not necessarily a big deal. So you can calculate predictively in a non-normalizable theory. It's conceptually not that much different than what a normalizable theory would have been. If you recognize that being a non-normalizable, what it's really telling you is that there's two scales in the problem, and the physics that you're interested in cares about the scale, the next highest scale that you're ignoring. So that it cares about the physics that it cares about physics that's suppressed by powers of this other scale, whatever it is. And it's because you're trying to follow that physics, which actually cares about this third scale, that the theory is coming to you in a non-normalizable way. But given that, if you organize things in the low energy calculation compared to that scale, there will be some parameters which you may be able to calculate from something fundamental, or you may not. You may be taking from experiment. The logic of the rest of the calculation is just like for our normalizable theory. And the only difference is that you're working some non-trivial order in one gram rather than stopping at zero order. So quantum calculations. This is like a moral. Can be done in a predictable and controlled. And in cases that we really understand what's going on, like the Beckett theory of the Fermi-Wiegand directions, or high on dynamics, you can take your calculation and compare them to an experiment and test that it's really working. And it works. And the test can be at the level where you have to do the quantum corrections to make them work. So in some cases, calculations can be compared experiment work. So those examples would be weak interactions. There's many examples, but this is power perturbation theory, which is the pions. So there's a wealth of information throughout physics that what I'm telling you about is complete bullshit. And so the thing about gravity is that, so what's the big deal about quantum gravity? So here it now depends what your goals are. So if your goals are to understand low energy physics compared to whatever the scale is, so the problem is, it's a kind of famous observation that general relativity is not normalizable. And that a lot of work has been spent on, so how do you deal with that? And kind of the hardcore attitude which people had, including, you know, Dirac and Feynman and people in the 60s, before this was understood in non-gravitation physics, was that you had this split brain where, you know, the gravity half of your brain, C could be 1, but H bar was 0. You do things classically, but you have no idea what quantum mechanics means for predicting. And then your H bar equals 1 half of your brain is where quantum electromagnetics lives. You can do things incredibly accurately, including quantum corrections, but nothing drops. So those two halves of the brain don't get to talk to each other. And then, so there's no one framework of all of physics that you can say we understand and we're now pushing the boundaries of. There'd be two separate camps of physics and they can't talk to each other, which is not a very satisfying point of view. And it also means that if you have no idea of how to relate them, then that means there's an unresolved theoretical error potentially in everything you do. So how do you know that gravitational corrections to the Lamb shift don't screw up your success of your experiments, your progressive experiment? On the other hand, how do you know that quantum effects for gravity don't screw up your successful predictions using general relativity in the solar system? And this development of, the, of a point of view that came from non-gravitational physics solves that problem. So, so if you're interested in places where you're testing gravity, you're interested in particular in very low energies compared to whatever the scale of gravity is, which could be the Planck scale for all we know. But it's certainly all the gravitational tests, all the in practice tests of gravity are being done at energy research. Michael, I'm in the middle of class here, left the center modulator. And keep in mind, it is controlled by a low energy. And now, does that mean there's nothing interesting in quantum gravity? No. If you're the interesting problems in quantum gravity are the ones that people like you all work on. Those are the questions of what happens in a black hole, or what happens in the early universe, or what's going on, what's space-time really like when you get down to really small distances. Those are asking questions at the scale that we are trying to ignore when we just do general relativity in this low-energy way. And those are really interesting questions. What really is going on at the fundamental scale of gravity? How many dimensions do you have? Those are great questions, but it's important to know where the problems are, so you can focus your attention on where the problems are. And so there's not going to be a lot of profit in spending a lot of time tuning your theory of gravity to get the solar system right, because if you get the solar system, if you get general relativity roughly right, you're going to get it right in spades, because anything that, once you have a massless spin 2 particle in a weak field regime, it will be described by general relativity, and so then everything that works in general relativity and all its predictions and all its successes will come for free, basically, once you've got that particle content. And so the understanding of the weak field regime and the constraints that leads to it, and I haven't gone into that, I mean, the gauge invariance issues and why it is that general relativity emerges as the description of that kind of a degree of freedom is all really interesting, but that's something which is in the low energy theory. And whatever you're doing microscopically won't change the success of that. It's just something which is, it's the low energy limit. There's no evidence that gravity is any different from anything else as far as the decoupling of scales. And if there was evidence that gravity, small distance physics appeared in some uncontrolled way, you have to go back and re-understand why we understand anything. You know, if it was true that you could get information from beyond the Planck scale in some way that you liked, say an inflation or a black hole, you have to then ask, well, why isn't it happening in the room all around us all the time? And so the huge success, effective field theories are really just the mathematical description of a property of nature that we don't need to understand small distance physics. We don't have evidence that small distance physics is occurring everywhere all around us at longer distances. Nature scales decouple from one another, and the mathematics of quantum field theory expresses that fact. And effective field theories just take advantage of that fact in an efficient way in organizing their calculus. And so understanding where the problems are in art in quantum gravity is it's important to take advantage of what's working for you. It means that it'll be very difficult to test different kinds of quantum gravity because they're going to like to agree with each other to the extent that they give you the same kinds of general features at long distances, like are they length and branch, or are they do they have more than just the spin 2 particle or not. And it tells you where to focus. Focus on places where the gravitational fields are strong, or focus where on very short distances. It also tells you if you want to test them experimentally, it's really important to understand what the effective field theory is that you get from your theory of gravity to see how it differs from general theory, because that's where the tests would be. And without having that, it's difficult to know how to compare any particular approach to experiment. That's the speech. So how do you do this? So now, given what you normally would take for the Lagrangian normally for general relativity would have had minus rho g. Then you would have had Planck squared over 2, I'll leave space here. Planck squared over 2, the Schwarzschild scalar. Could have had a cosmological term. And then you would have stopped there normally. That's where Einstein would have stopped. But if we're thinking of this as an effective field theory, then what we should be doing is writing down all possible things that are consistent with the symmetry of the problem. And we organize things in powers of derivatives and fields. And by organizing things that way, implicit in that organization is that we're thinking that once we power count to ask how these interactions appear in observables, the ones that are higher dimension with more derivatives are going to be the ones that are only important at higher orders in the expansion of the orders. So they'll be less relevant. So in that spirit, what I'll do is I'll organize things in powers of derivatives. And so in this case, you know, our field is dimensionless. But it's like the pion field in the paraperiodic theory in the Goldstone boson case, that it's dimensionless, but it's governed by this general covariance. Where, you know, G mu is red mu C mu. So the requirement for this thing to be built out of G as a general covariant is a very strong one. And so the fact that you have all possible powers of G and G inverse appear doesn't really bother you, because that's going to be controlled by general covariance. And what this derivative expansion becomes is a curvature expansion, because those are the general covariant combinations of derivatives of the metric that are the only things you're allowed to write down if you're actually supposed to be general covariant. So the next thing that's going to appear here will be, you could have had something with blocks of R, so derivatives of R, or we could have had curvature squared terms, like Ricci scalar squared, G3, Ricci tensor squared, we could have had Riemann squared. And that's it at the level of dimension of 4. This is dimension 2 because remember the Christoffel symbols are things like this 1/2 g mu lambda, g mu sigma, and there's a bunch of things involving dg, dg minus dg. So if g is dimensionless, the derivative here is dimensions of 1 over length, so these things have dimensions of mass. And then the Riemann tensor is derivatives of this, right? So it's like d rho gamma mu lambda plus another derivative minus gamma gamma. And so all these things have two derivatives in them, so the Riemann tensor is more like mass squared, or 1 over length squared. The box here is just g mu grad mu grad mu. So it's dimension 2. So you see this thing has got dimensions of mass to the fourth. This has got dimensions of mass to the squared, because it has to combine between something with mass to the fourth. These things have dimensionless coefficients, because there's two powers of mass here, two more there. Four powers there, four powers there, four powers there. And the contraction of the indices is just something symmetric, which is dimensionless. And then, next thing, we're always going to have in two dimensions, because we're always taking something which is Lorentz invariant at the end of the day, and so we have to contract. An extra index has to come in pairs so we can contract it, because the only thing we can contract is our metrics, which have 2 indices, or epsilon symbols, which have 4. So I guess I could have written that down here somewhere. But rather than writing all these operators, I want to write a couple examples of the next ones to make a point, which I think I've probably already made before. But so we'll see C4 over squared R cubed, and there's many other terms that I've already found. So these guys have dimensionless coefficients. This guy has dimensions 1 over mass squared, and I've deliberately written it because I wanted to emphasize again that what we're expecting is that this mass will probably be the lightest particle we misintegrated out at whatever energy we're interested in. Because if we had started at the Planck scale and come down in energies and integrated out particles, if I integrated out an electron, that electron loop, and I put gravitons on the ends of it, then a graph like this can give me something like this. And the scale that will appear will be the electron mass, in much the same way as when we had the photon, we've got f mu to the fourth, divided by the electron mass to the fourth. The scale in the loop was the electron, but nothing else. So if we get this kind of thing from integrating a particle, we'll get it with the mass of wherever it's involved. But we'll get a contribution from the electron, the muon, from everybody who gravitates, and everybody does gravitate, so they're all in there. So there'll be a sum of terms which all go like inverse masses, and it's the lightest one that will win. So for below the electron mass, then it'll be the one that dominates here. Below the neutrino mass, maybe it's the neutrino that dominates here. It's they all couple with the same strength by the equivalence principle, so it's really the mass that controls who wins. And so I'm kind of laboring in this because people will often write this rounded down, but what they'll write here will be a Planck squared. And there probably is a term within Planck squared there, but it's going to be swamped by this term of electron mass, if you're below the electron mass. If you're applying this effective theory during inflation, where your energies involved are much higher than the electron mass, then of course you won't have a term of electron mass here because you haven't figured that out yet. So electron is still in your theory. But it'll be whatever the mass was of the particle you last figured out. So it's the scale, the smallest scale is bigger than the scales you're interested in.
Excuse me, why the vibe sensor is
the Valtensor the Valtensor is just Riemann tensor minus the Ricci tensor that you scatter under the power. So as long as I can take all the powers of these guys, I can organize that as a Valtensor and other things. So yeah, what's the program? So what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to ask, first of all, we should first ask, are these all independent operators? And because it might be, in principle, what we'd want to do is go off and calculate a bunch of observed roles. We want to figure out which of these interactions appears at which order in the loop expansion. So we quantify how big its effects will be. And if we have ultraviolet divergences, we're going to go into normalization for these things. But it may be that if some of these interactions are redundant, then it might be that all observable roles might depend on some particular inter combinations of these coefficients. And it's worth knowing that early, rather than spending a lot of time trying to figure out, trying to find an observer. It's going to, for instance, it'll happen that if we're just doing this in the solar system, that only one of these four interactions is independent. And the other ones are actually never, you'll never be able to find observables in the solar system which will distinguish these coefficients from one another. And that's because they're redundant in the sense that we've talked about already. So our second step is which of these make up a basis of independent interactions? So I want to know who is a base redundant. So the two automatic ways to be redundant would be if you're a total derivative, unless you're interested in some physics-dependent boundary. So example of redundancy would be total derivatives. So unless boundary effects are important. With a field reduction, and one sign that you can be removed by a field reduction would be if you can remove it by, if you can make it zero by using the equation of the motion of the lowest order terms. So in this case, the lowest order thing. So in this case, there's a naturalness issue that we talked about already with this term, right? That this should be the biggest scale of the problem because it's positive power. But it's measured to be very small. So there's a question mark here. That's the cosmological constant problem. Is why is that not bigger than this, than it's measured to be? So when I take the zeroth order of Lagrangian, I'm going to be thinking of this term. And in principle, if I'm really doing perturbation theory, what I should be doing is I should be choosing the space-time, and I should be looking at fluctuations around that space-time. So when we organize perturbation theory, what we will do around some particular vacuum, which is another way of saying another thicker class configuration. That means it will take Gv nu to be some background G bar mu nu plus some fluctuation H mu nu. And we'll normalize this fluctuation in such a way that the kinetic term for it is H mu nu box H mu nu, so it will be some standard kinetic term. And that involves having a coefficient here which is 1 over so some number about the nth Planck. Because this nth Planck, when I expand this out, so it's going to be R is going to, if I just written this as being, say, lambda h mu nu, then if I expand out r mu nu, or the scalar curvature r, it has a piece which is the background curvature, and then there's a piece which is basically box with respect to background metric of h mu nu and lambda. And in the in the root g, I'll get another. What happens to my effects when I want to write here? When I contract this to make scalar, then I'll get a piece when I do the expansion of this in the inverse metric, which is going to be h mu box h mu nu, which is the kinetic term. And you can see that what will happen is I'm going to get 1 power of lambda in the expansion of this term. And so that power of lambda, but I'll get 1 power of lambda for each h. So that means that r will have things like r of r plus lambda squared h mu nu box bar h mu nu plus other things. And so if I want this coefficient to be 1, then I have to use lambda squared to cancel this with Planck squared. And so that's why what we'll do is choose lambda to be some number over Planck when I'm actually doing the calculation. And with that choice, the metric was dimensionless, background metric was dimensionless, this combination with dimensionless, so if I make lambda 1 over m Planck, then now h is got dimensions of mass, so it's got the canonical dimension of the bosonic field, like the ones we've talked about so far. So when we do this expansion and decide what's normalizable and what's not, and what's expressed by power of 1 over m Planck and what's not, this 1 over m Planck will play a role in that story. But when I'm making these redundancy arguments, I don't need to be that detailed, because these redundancy arguments really all I'm really relying on is that I'm taking a lower order part of the action, finding its equation of motion, and then using that to simplify a higher order part. And what's going to transpire is that the when we power count this is something I'm just telling you what the answer is going to be. It's going to turn out to be that once we organize the perturbation theory in that way, all the interactions in here, in general, for relativistic systems, will be equally important. So when I'm using the equation of the motion to simplify things, what I'll use is I'll use the equation of the motion from this whole action, which will be the Einstein equations. I won't use just the linearized equations, although I could take the argument order by order in the linearized equations too, and it's just much harder to do. So how do you do that? So you simplify the box R squared and on terms using the Einstein equations, which say that if I just take the R term, they say that minus equals 0. And that, if I trace the equation, says that it's practically the R mu 0. And so if I now go through and ask, what can I simplify using this equation, and what are total derivatives? Then you can see that this one is a total derivative. These two vanish when I use the Einstein equations. These can be removed with a field redefinition. And this is the first one that we hit. But it turns out that in four dimensions, this is also a total derivative, because there's a combination of this, this, and this, which is the Fourier density. And so it's always a total derivative. And so unless you're looking at something which gives a topology, this is also a total derivative in four dimensions. So the first things you would actually see in the vacuum are things up here.
but could we derive this equation of motion using only first two terms, right?
Just this term.
Yeah, right? And just allow it.
So is it like correct procedure when we say, okay, we use this equation to simplify the whole action?
Yeah. And that's because when you see later on, so just I'm asking you to suspend just leave for a second, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to power cap these directions. And you'll see that the leading order in that, so that will identify what the small thing is that we're doing the expansion. And it'll tell you also which terms are the ones that are the dominant ones and which ones are not dominant. And the dominant ones are going to be the ones that come this, not just connect term, but all the interactions here, too, for all equally functionally important. So given that that's what the answer is going to be, then I should think of this thing as being a leading part of the lower to the project. That's why you use this whole equation function. Yes?
So the WOW script term that you say is a topological term. And I was told by people who do asymptotic safety that it has some quantum implications, but is that only when it's non-prohibitive?
What were the implications that it had?
It had quantum effects, like it changed, it was different. I'd have to know more to comment, but I think it,
to the extent that it's true that its coefficient can be normalized, which might be what they're doing. But if you ask, does it make it, if you actually use it to calculate some observable, then it should drop out with two provisos. So the two provisos are, it's very much like in the case of the gauge theory. If you have that gauge theory, then those are much like the epsilon, the union, lambda, rho, lambda, rho terms. That's something which is a total derivative, but it actually, so there's two things you could ask. You could ask, does this coefficient renormalize as I integrate out other things? Which I think is probably they were expecting them to do. And then it is true the coefficient renormalized. But if you ask, why do I care about the value of that coefficient? And I ask, does it mean anything when I calculate anything observable? Then it becomes a question of whether or not these total derivatives is something you see. So in the case of quantum electrodynamics, you don't care because all the observables don't care about the boundary, unless you're doing a boundary problem like Casimir Kreis. But if you're doing something like QCD where topology is important, then you care because this is sampling the topology because that's something which cares about the total derivatives. And so I would say that,
I think you said there were eight different observables.
So I would say they have to be topology dependent or boundary dependent observables then. But then we didn't know what they were. So we would have had nice to know. Was this in the talk? Did we have carried out the first one?
Sir?
Was this something that was said in the talk or just during the discussion?
During the discussion.
Oh, okay. The second proviso is, and this could also be what's going on, is that we had a similar discussion when we were doing electromagnetism for the term which is FP nu, box FP nu, which equation of motion in that case was box FP nu equals zero. But if you had currents, if you had sources, then this wasn't, this did have physical consequences, but I could trade that for, in that case, it was something like d nu, j nu, things involving current, I can't remember what they were. This is I think, from something like j, yeah, it must be something involving j's. I think on dimensional grounds, derivative of f goes like j, so if I have two f's and two derivatives, it must be just two j. So if I got a term like this when I was typing, if I use the equation of motion to give you nu, f nu is equal to j nu, then the equation of motion doesn't make this vanish, it turns it into something else. And that's still useful to use this information, but that says that the effects of this term won't be important unless I actually ask the question which cares about the matter distribution, the currents themselves. And there's a similar statement here. And when I use the equation of motion to kill all these terms, I'm using that this is true. But if I'd been in the presence of matter, then this would have been the immediate some provision. And so what this argument would have done in that case would have been to trade these guys for teeming new terms, which you could think of as being interactions which, if I looked at, say, the gravitational force between two objects, it's something which won't make any difference if these objects don't touch each other. But once they touch each other, then it'll be a contact force that you'd miss if you didn't follow these terms or create them for their proverbial contact interactions. But the advantage of this is showing you that it's only a contact interaction. It's not meeting a long distance interaction, say, as you might have thought, given that it's changing how the graviton propagates. So in cosmology, for instance, where we're living inside the fluid, where TV is not zero, these kind of things can survive. But in the solar system, they typically are only important if you're bringing matter and contact with each other. So it's, the redundancy argument works, but what you have to be careful about what it's redundant with. So are they irrelevant or are they equivalent to contact contractions? But the logic for deciding that is always the same. So that's the first thing. So there's not a lot of things that are... In the old days, this came up in the, from the point of view that when you calculate one loop, you calculate one loop ultraviolet divergences for graviton scattering, people were interested in the old days, they were interested in, well, maybe gravity looks more normalizable, but it happens like it's, maybe it's not actually calculating things. And a piece of evidence for that was if you at one loop calculate graviton scattering and ask what the divergences are, they happen to vanish in the scattering amplitude. Green's functions don't. Are divergent, but when you actually go on shell and calculate a scattering amplitude, then all the divergences go away. And from this point of view, it's clear what was going on. What was going on is that at one loop, you'll see that the divergences would all have to be in these terms here. What happens that if you're looking at scattering processes, those are things that don't depend on boundaries, they don't depend on contact interactions. So it happens to be that the four dimensions, okay, these terms just drop out. And so there's no miracle in that particular absence of ultraviolet divergences for those kinds of divergences.
So you're saying that the only terms that don't can be removed by further definitions are ones that are involved in redundancy or redundancy?
What I'm saying is if these curvature square terms in four dimensions, their total effect will be something that you can describe instead by a TMU address.
Okay. All right.
As long as you never ask a boundary question.
Yeah.
So supposing that we forget about the mass, the solar system case, what would be the first term that could be not neglected?
In the solar system, so just if we're really finished. Then that would be one of the curvature cube terms. So it would be like something like Riemann cube, for instance, there's a term like that. Because the Riemann squared was almost there, it's just the topology happened to be topological. So anything involving Riemann could be.
Yeah. So, but it would be the Riemann cube. You could rewrite it as basically wild cube because all the non-wild terms can be redefined up to zero, right? So right. Something like wild cube.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's probably more than one. I haven't thought through what the others, but you might be able to take derivatives of the rich tensor. No, actually not those vanished.
Because those are other.
Well, you can make derivatives that are not total derivatives, but it's true that if the rich tensor is vanishing everywhere, it's derivative of those vanished. All right, so let me move on to the perturbation theory part of it. And so the next thing you do is once you identify what your interactions are that you might be interested in, then you ask, well, let's now calculate something. So the good news here would be that if you wanted to calculate, the first actual calculations, which this point of view emerged in the 80s, but the first actual calculations happened in the fairly recently in the 90s. And so they tended to be complicated by the fact that they were asking non-relativistic questions. They'd ask, what's the deviation from Newton's law coming from quantum mechanics? And the people that calculated it found a deviation which goes like g h bar, g Newton h bar over r squared or something, correcting the g m over r potential. So there's an m. But this quantum effect is an ultraviolet finite effect. They never had any problems with the ultraviolet divergences because of this argument. One way of seeing why was that the only things that would have been divergent are these things, and those things are actually contact interactions. So there is a force term which is really delta of r, which does have a divergent coefficient coming from these guys, but if you're looking at this one of our dispersion term, you don't see it because it's these things don't contribute to that observable. So it's useful to have a sense as to which of these guys are ever going to be showing up in any anterior system. Kind of another calculation like that is people calculated the force between two cosmic strings because for classically, the cosmic string doesn't curve space around itself, it just has a conical defect that goes just for the string. So you put two cosmic strings and they shouldn't feel a force because they're reached in flat space as far as they're concerned. And so that means that the leading contribution to the force would be the quantum one. And so that's also an interesting calculation to do. Anytime you've got a leading effect which is quantum mechanical, it's interesting, and even though it's practiced, you'll never measure it. But What's nice there is that the same argument shows you that that should be held for like finite calculation because that is. So you might have thought that calculation of the one force is going to be swamped with all kinds of divergent issues that are normalizable, but this shows you why there's actually a lot of things you're going to calculate that aren't going to care about divergence. And so that takes us to perturbations into the power counting. So what we need to do is power count using this Lagrangian. See which interactions show up in which intervals. So what's not clear from what I told you so far is why at one loop you only care about curvature square terms. How did you know that it wasn't a curvature to the 15th term, which is the port at one loop, which would have been making an effect? So that's where the power counting will tell us. So the way I'm going to do the power counting is the same way I did before. And so I'm going to set it up as if we're expanding around flat space. But I want you to recognize that the argument I'm making is a dimensional analysis argument. And so we could have, if we wanted to, have done it in position space. And in position space, we could have, in principle, done this for any background geometry or not any background geometry, but we could have done it for slowly varying background geometries. And if there's event horizons, there's separate issues to think about. But if you get some like the geometry in the solar system, say, where this is a slowly varying metric, then the argument we're making, because it's a dimensional argument, works equally well, because in position space the dimensions work the same way. And in essence, all it's coming down to is that the big scales of the problem are these ones here, this one and the ones that are in these interactions. And all the small scales of the problem are coming from whatever is inside the loop. And in essence, when I made the argument before, all those scales for simplicity typically be the same. We're just taking all the energies from the same and all the masses from the same in the one theory. And that's a particularly simple case to think about. And then on dimensional grounds, we identify where these big masses are coming from because we know where they go in the vertices. And then we use dimensional regularization, so we don't introduce any new scales, we'll regularize the graph in the infrared and the ultraviolet. And then all the other dimensions we're just saying are coming from whatever the lower scale is. And that's an argument that works equally well in position space as momentum space. So, although I'm going to make the argument in a perturbation on flat space, I want it to be clear that the power counting I'm giving you is not specific to perturbation on flat space because of the fifth dimensional analysis. And together with the structure of these graphs. So, power count. I'm in a special, so I will specialize. It's only on graph topology. So I have things like the number of external lines is related to the number of internal lines and the number of vertices in a particular way. Dimensional analysis. If I do it in dimensional regularization, it also goes through. G where we deal with this curve. But I have to ask for the curvature to be of the same order of magnitude as the other scales of the theory. So if R bar is of the order of the low energy scale, let's call it E squared low energy.
Should this R hydrocarbon is that the source for the cells?
You mean in a sense is there a linear term? Source means specifically linear in fluctuation. What I'll always have with the source terms are it's the same story as you would have had for a scalar field. Remember what happened, and it depends on what you calculate. Supposing we calculate the effective, the one DI effective action or something. where we had an integral e to the I gamma of phi. It's a kind of integral e to the I background phi plus fluctuation phi integral d4x current. And it was taken to be a function of phi fluctuation. So the question you're asking is if I expand this thing around at some point, which is not a stationary point of the act, not a classical solution, which I can imagine doing it, because I can evaluate this as a function of any arbitrary field theory. You're saying that there's going to be things that are linear in the fluctuation here, and that looks like this is a source of that. And in that sense, that will happen. But this is also a source in a way. And remember what happened was that if I expanded the same parts of phi, there was an S of phi came out of the actual. Then there was a linear term S prime of phi times phi schematically in the 1/2 S prime of phi times phi squared and so on. So the logic was that this was the integral, that's the classical approximation. This is the thing that I'll make this a Gaussian integral for, so that's the thing I still my propagators that I'm going to use to normalize everything. But this is the perturbation which I would have done a series in when taking the exponential. And this guy, what it was doing, it was combining this guy to lop off all the one parts of the useful graphs. And so I never actually had to calculate with them. But if I actually did path integral, I would be calculating all the for the path integral, I'd be calculating all the graphs connected or disconnected. I take a logarithm to get gamma, I'm calculating one of the connected graphs. And then, but I would be doing all the reducible ones too. But it's because I'm going to then take J and write J, you know, evaluate it at J equals minus gamma of phi. That choice will then go through and cancel off all the reducible graphs. And so effectively what I really do is I calculate all the one part of the reducible graphs and ignore that vertex. Because all I was going to do is contribute to those one graphs that are going to cancel out. So they're there, but then you need to write care about them. So you get your turn. But it makes a difference, you know, if you keep cosmological constant term, say, and then you try and expand around flat space, then things will look funny because you should be systematic in how you do this expansion. So what we need to do is power count again. And so remember we had a power counting, I just want to remind you what the power counting argument we had before was. We had Lebrun, we said it was somewhat a bunch of interactions, and we had a gate, a scale up front, some coefficient, some power of m, two dimensions, that had some operator, which is a function of the field, divided by b, and derivatives. And so I chose this to be whatever power I need to, because I divided phi by b, the only dimensions in this thing were coming from the derivatives, and then whatever those dimensions were, I divided, so this d is the number of derivatives, and so I have m to that d. These are dimensionless coefficients, and then the overall scale, it makes the dimensions probably about 2 to the f, but in particular examples, f and m and v were often related to each other. But I chose this to be reasonably general, so it was going to capture, it captured the quantum electrodynamics case we did, and it captured the Coulson-Boson case we did. They all had this form. And this is similar to that. This is almost like that, but not quite. If we didn't have this issue of this scale being different, supposing everywhere we've written M Planck, then we would have had something of this form. So if we had so our Lagrangian, let me rewrite it so we can erase that board, which was minus curve minus g and plus minus curve c. I'll just schematically write the terms r squared plus c phi. This is by writing this. If I call this theta, you know, the dimensionless variable here, in the chiral perturbation theory, the story of the Coulson bosons, we were getting functions of the interaction were dimensionless functions of dimensionless scalar field, which was some angle to do with some symmetric transformation, And then there's a B with something which I was putting in to canonically normalize things, and maybe kinetic don't have the right size. And so what we're doing here is very similar to that, because this, these Rs are all functions of the metric and derivatives metric of B inverse A, PG. That has very much the same kind of size dependence on the fields as the R operators of boson boson case did. So I should think of the this thing here as being like a dimensionless field. And so V, in that case, so when I write G as being G bar plus whatever M Planck H, this combination is very much like theta. H is very much like phi. So M Planck is very much like V. So I should think of V as something like M Planck. And then in that sense, these, what I've written here is very much like this. If this is an M Planck, so if this is an M Planck, then it would be true that the derivatives, each R is counting a derivative, it's just two derivatives. And if the dimensions were to be set by M Planck, then I could think of M being M Planck. Provided this was M Planck as well. So I think, so I've got two options here. What I had to actually do is just ignore this term because it's so small. But what I could do is I could take this as being M Planck to the fourth power with this very small coefficient, and then separately follow how that coefficient appears on the graphs. Because it's so small, it won't appear in anything we're going to do. But let me just simplify the argument I'm going to give with this, just throw it away. But you could include it if you want to, in much the same way as I'm about to do this. And then this F, so if that were not there, then if I wrote this, if I pulled an M Planck fourth out of this whole thing, then I really would have exactly what I'm talking about here. I would have had, so if I kept this term, I would have had C, if I wrote this as being C minus 1 M Planck fourth, if that's very small, I would have had C minus 1. And here I would have had plus 1 half R over M Planck squared plus C1 R squared over M Planck fourth. So you see, by pulling out the M Planck, the dimensions have been counted in the way I told you with the M Plancks. And the only thing that's screwing this argument up, if these had all been M Plancks, we would have been business, but we would have had C5 R cubed over M Planck 6. And then this would have been really, we could just look at what I did here. But we don't have the Planck scale here, we have some smaller scale here. So I can do this as long as I keep in mind that there's, I really had a factor here of, Planck squared over M squared. So this coefficient is bigger than you thought it was if you're using M Planck as your units, because it's really suppressed by only M squared rather than M squared. And if I did some higher thing, like if I had R to the fourth, I would have been neither putting M Planck to the eighth here. But I should have really only had a 1 over M to the fourth here, so I would have had M Planck over M. And so on. So what I want to do is to save work, what I'll do is I'm writing this as being almost like what we did before, but with a correction, and I just need to follow what the corrections do. And so the spirit of this one would have been the same. If this had been order one, it would fall into what we did before. But really, I should be thinking of this thing, if this was really new to the fourth, then this C is really, I should think of it being new to the fourth, by the way, I'm applying to the fourth. And so, whereas these are enhancements compared to what I would have expected of these in order one coefficients, this is a suppression, so that's why I'm not skipping this one. But it's going to be important to follow these guys around, because this means that there are contributions which are bigger than we would be getting if we just use this argument with a blank everywhere. And so, the only change I'm going to have compared to what we did before will be I'm going to follow, for the cubic and higher terms, the fact that there's a power of a blank over a little down running around. See what that does. Okay, so now I'll just repeat the argument that we had before. Okay, so what I do is I pick some process, and I'm going to treat it like I'm doing a dimensional space, but again, it's dimensional analysis, so it's nothing different. I've got some E thermal lines. B vertices of kind of what I did before. Vertices, and each vertex has B derivatives. So in this expansion as far as of h, if it has h to the nth, then this is what n will be. If it's got, you know, six derivatives, then b will be six. I count how many of each type I have. My internal lines. And then I have the identities, where we have the conservation of n's. Because that doesn't change. And it says that if I count the ends of lines as coming from counting the lines, then I would have the number of external lines plus twice the number of internal lines. That should be the same as the number of ends at the end of each vertex. So that should be sum over b and n, b, b, n, n. And then we had the definition of a loop. L was, well, basically what it was the number of faces, which is the number of loops, minus the number of external lines, plus the number of vertices, being the one. And so you remember the logic of that was, if we had been looking at graphs, which were planar graphs, which could be drawn on a plane, and those topologically were discs, and this was a thing that the other number of discs is one, and the other number you can always calculate as being the number, if you triangulate a surface, it's the number of faces minus the number of edges plus the number of corners. So in this case, this is just a statement that all the things that are written on a plane have the topology of a disk. But if it can't be written on a plane, then this is just what we mean by L. And so those two things, then what we did is we took the amplitude, and we say that it's got, you know, it's got, in momentum space, each vertex gave me a delta function times pi and fourth. It gave me whatever the coefficients were. Some c's, which I was ignoring typically. I got a 1 over m to the d. I got a 1 over b to the number of vertices. And I got an energy. Each t, and I had that as many times as I had vertices, and I'm going to have a product over all numbers of vertices. Each internal line gave me a propagator, which was an integral p for p, 1 by 2 pi to the fourth, 1 over p squared, plus some small energy squared, which I'll call q squared again. So imagine the small energy is the little q. Now that could instead be the curvature. Background or whatever your scale is in the moment you carry. And one of those are going to be a line. And that was it, right? Not quite, because the propagator, I wrote a propagator like in case it could kind of normalize. But if this is my Lagrangian, then the thing with two derivatives and two fields is a special case of this. And so it actually is multiplied by f to the fourth divided by m squared, b squared. So the thing in the path integral, so the thing with two derivatives here, with you know, d phi, according to this rule, it should have been multiplied by f to the fourth. Two derivatives was 1 over m squared. Two fields was 1 over b squared. And so if I write that as being phi d squared phi, and my propagator is the inverse of this operator, then my propagators have to all have 1 over this factor. So I should have that be b squared m squared. And I forgot to write that factor back to the fourth here too. So then we go to town. You know, I repeat the argument I made before, and there's you use this identity a couple times. You get rid of things like the number of internal lines, which is hard to quantify. And the only thing I have to do now is I have to keep track of this new feature that for every time I use a vertex with derivatives more than 3, then I have this factor of x squared over m squared. So what I should do is So for every for D, so that this is only applying for D at least 6, right? Because the first time we see one over M squared is when we have 3 curvatures, which is 6 derivatives. And then what we should get here is we should get M like over M to the D minus 4. So if D is equal to 6, then we get 2 powers. If D equals 8, we get 4 powers, and that kind of captures what's going on here. And that's just saying that the dimensions for these particular interactions are expressed by this little scale M. That erases the number of those persons. So this is the only change from what I did last time. So, okay. So, you know, yada, yada, yada. And let's go to the answers. So the bottom line is that the amplitude is equal to q. Q7 becomes q squared Planck squared over Planck over lines q over 4 pi and Planck twice the loops. Product over n, product d bigger than 2 of q over lambda squared, q over lambda d minus 4. So if we didn't have this last factor, then it would be the same as what I gave before. And all that's happening is that I'm just telling you how this factor. Sure, sir. And it's kind of plausible how it occurs because it's just appearing. If this was in d bigger than 2, so that means it's d bigger than or equal to 4. So when d is equal to 4, this isn't here. And that's the right answer for the curvature square term. It shouldn't have a section enhancement. But for d bigger than 4, then you get this power q over m d minus 4, which is what this is like. And everything else is exactly what I gave before. If you chose f equals v equals m Planck, then that's the rest of this is what you were about. Alright. And there was a variety of ways of writing that, right? So the I gave you several ways of writing it depending on what you're trying to emphasize with the answer. So we do the exercise that we had before. So the first question is, so let's take a fixed B. So a fixed number of external lines, some process, I don't care what it is. What is the dominant contribution? So what we're trying to do is we're fixed E, so we're just trying to minimize this factor and this factor, because those are the ones that are suppressing, I guess, the first like, zero sort of thing, which is important to that, it's just a what is it that controls the series? And that is that these things have to be small. So we have to have a q much less than Planck. Not surprised there. But also, q much smaller than little m. Because those are the things that are appearing as positive powers in this process. So that's something which probably you would have bought anyway. This is something which when you think about it, once you recognize that the scale and the denominator could be small, the Planck scale, then you kind of realize that you have people compressing it. So no surprise there. What is the dominant piece? Division. And D is fixed. And so there are the idea is that how do we minimize this? Well, the first thing we'll do is make L equals 0. So we'll make L equals 0. And then the minimize the rest of the stuff, what we want to do is if we, we're always being punished here by some power of Q as long as we include anything with D bigger than 4. So what we should do is never include anybody who's got 4 or more derivatives. So, so if VND equals 0, if D is greater than 4. So what's that say? That says that in our original Lagrangian, we're supposed to take tree graphs, so that's classical physics, using any number of interactions involving only 2 derivatives, which is from the Einstein curve. So this is IE, classical general relativity. So that probably doesn't surprise you that the classical limit should be the dominant limit in low energies, and this kind of makes sense. Precise. But importantly, it tells you what the correction is to that limit. So the second thing is, what's the first subdominant correction? And so what happens there is, well, so we, the fewest powers of Q, well, sorry, before I do that, I should, there's one more thing I want to say here. So for example, let's take E equals 4. So let's take those gravitons scattering. So this tells you not only, at least the graphs do, it tells you how they depend on the energy. So let's take this case. If E is equal to 4, then we expect the amplitude to go like, we expect Q squared and Planck squared, 1 over M Planck to the 4th, the no loop factor and the no other factor, right? So this whole thing should go like Q squared over M Planck squared. Does that mean the cross section should go like the amplitude? Amplitude squared integrated over phase space. So that on dimensional grounds, the cross section is a length squared, so that's 1 over energy squared. So it's going to go like q to the 4th, because of that, divided by m Planck to the 4th. But then the phase space integral will give us the rest of the dimensions. That's all the energy scales, because that's integrating over the energies that were available in these certain lines. So that has to get rid of two of these powers of 2. And it happens that, so we're expecting the thing to go like energy squared in the cross section. And this has been calculated, so the cross section, you take the specific, you know, so positive velocity gravitons going to 2 gravitons of the same velocity, then that answer turns out to be 8 pi g s cubed over 2 u. Where g is Newton's constant, so g is 8 pi g is what I'm calling the number of pi squared. And ST and E are the amplitude variables. If you have, you know, if you have the scattering process, if you have P1, P2 going, something happens, and P3, P4 come out. There's only 2 independent Lorentz invariant things you can make out of these 4 momenta, given that they satisfy that P1 plus P2 and P3. So, S is defined to be the thing involving only the initial state, minus P1 plus P2 squared. And so, if we went to the center of mass frame where this is just energy, then this would have been twice the center of mass energy squared. And T is defined to be the one combination of the one of the internal guys. Initial guys, one of the final guys, and U is the other one. So it's minus P1 3 squared minus 4 squared. So the Lorentz invariant, you know, if you take all the dot products I could have made with P, there's P1 dot P2, P1 dot P4, P1 dot P3. So that's why there's 3 of them. But they're not independent, except there's only 2, and that's because this statement says that if I take P1, if P1 squared is 0 for gravitons, that's equal to P2 squared, P3 squared, P4 squared, it's always equal to the mass minus the mass squared of the particle involved. So if I take P1 dot P1 plus P2 minus P3 minus P4, that shows you that's 0. So, and this P1 squared is just 0 gravitons, that's the mass, so that's some number. That shows you that P1 dot P2 and P1 dot P3 and P1 dot P4 are not independent of one another. They have to add up to get away to get 0. So there's only 2 combinations of those 3 things that are independent. And if you take S plus T plus U, and just calculate it out here, this is a, in this case, it's pretty easy because the P's are all squared to zero. So we got minus 2 P1 dot P3 plus 2 P1 dot this one is P1 dot P2. This is plus 2 P1 dot P4. And you see that this combination is exactly the combination that had advantage, given that P squared is zero. In general, even the sum of the masses, the mass is not zero, but in this case, it's zero because got by the masses. And that's this relative signs is why I chose these guys. Those are differences, that's the sum. So that shows you that as far as energy goes, they're all going like energy squared. And so this is going like energy to the sixth power divided by energy to the fourth power is energy squared, and that's what we're expecting to happen. But it also shows you that you might have asked, whose energy are we talking about? And essentially, this is showing you that it's a Lorentz invariant combination of the momenta, which is scaling with energy. And so it's essentially the center mass energy that's appearing everywhere here. I could write these other things as being the energy of the center mass squared times the function of the angle, like 1 plus or minus cosine of the scattering angle, something like that. So it's the center mass energy which is setting the scale here. And that's something which everybody agrees on, because that's not a frame dependent, doesn't depend on how fast you're moving by the collision. That's something which is always internal to the relative motion of the particles that we apply. Something like that. Energy, center mass, squared over Planck to the fourth. That would happen if Planck to the fourth. Well, so this is the amplitude of the cross-section. So this amplitude is one like that over Planck squared, and that's what we were expecting the amplitude. So then you put it in the cross-section, you get something else, which I think we also recognize. So that shows you that the power counting is getting it right, classical level. It shows you that the thing that's counting as energy is a frame-dependent thing. And all you're missing is the factors of numerical factors of power. So now let's ask what's this first subnominant correction to see what the corrections of that would be. And you can see that there's two ways to get a correction. The next order in the powers of energy will be make L equals 1, or take one part, and that'll give us a q squared, if getting L equals 1. But we also get a q squared from this. But we don't want to get it from both places. So the options will be, we either take L equals 1, but still require that we only take D equals 2, so not allow D equals 4 or higher. And that would be one loop graphs coming from the Einstein action only. And the other alternative is we take L equals 0 still, but we let this thing have exactly power 1. So there's this one vertex involving derivative 4 or higher, which is allowed to be 1, and all the other ones are 0. And that'll give us one factor q squared from this. And we have to do it for the d equals 4 interaction, because otherwise we're going to get more than 2 powers of q, is this term. So the subdominant piece comes in two ways. Either L equals 1, and d equals 0, or all d equals 4. So this is one general relativity. Or we take L equals 0, d and d equals 1, or 1 for x equals 4. V and D equals 0 for D bigger than 4. And V and D equals anything for D equals 2. So we do a tree graph with general relativity with one vertex added from this curvature squared contraction, if we're there. So when you're deciding how things, I told you at some point that the one loop scattering amplitudes were ultraviolet finite. I told you then that the only counterterms that were going to be relevant were the ones coming from the curvature squared terms. And this is telling you why. So if you're doing the one-loop calculation in gravity, that's the subdominant in powers of, that will give us something which is corrected compared to what we got at the tree level by 2 powers of q over a Planck. The coefficient, if it diverges in the ultraviolet, but we'll have to renormalize something. The thing you have to renormalize is the only other thing that can be appearing at that order in q over a Planck. And that's these things that have precisely one vertex with 4 derivatives, and those are all coming from the curvature squared terms. So if you have an argument why those curvature squared terms aren't there, like they all vanish on shell, or they're all total derivatives, then it must be true that the ultraviolet divergences here you don't get all the vectors here, because the thing they would have to cancel with isn't there. So if you want to know what's being normalized in any given order, this is what you do. You recognize that Q over M Planck, or Q over M is the thing that's controlling the series. You ask how far down the series do I have to go, and then that will involve some number of loops with general relativity and other things. And then the other things that are appearing to that order are the things that will normalize, potentially, due to the ultraviolet divergences in general relativity to that order in Q over. So the spirit of it is exactly the same as it was in the other interactions. Just the details are a little bit different, because the counting of the scales is a little bit different. There's a thing I can say here about scalars which is basically, if you add scalars, it complicates things a little bit. But it's I wasn't going to do that unless there's a demand for it. So is there any questions with this? The moral here is that it's a very conservative point of view to take the general relativity at low energies as effective field theory in this way. Then you control the quantum corrections, you know how big they are. If you put in Q for the solar system, it's extremely small, so the corrections will be 1 part in 10 to 80. They're often ultraviolet finite, so the ultraviolet, the non-normalizability of general relativity is a bit of a red herring as far as predictability goes for quantum corrections. And it's important to know that. That's a piece of news that's kind of been slowly working its way out in the community, starting in the 80s, and there's still places where it hasn't been reached yet. And so the people that would actually probably run into this the most often are the cosmologists, because for cosmologists, one thing that's interesting that emerges in the when you include scalar fields in this is that cosmology is the one place that I know of where quantum effects in gravity are actually sizable enough that they could be relevant. You can see them. And that's if you include a scalar field and if your curvature Q is not so much lower than the Planck scale, which is true during inflation. So if Q might be the Hubble scale during inflation, the Hubble scale might be 10 to the minus 5 of the Planck scale. And so if that's where you'd like to be for inflation, then if you can measure things to 10 to the minus 5 accuracy, then you might see something. And that's the picture of fluctuations that are generated during inflation, is that they are generated by quantum fluctuations in the scalar field. And if you power counted the scalar field, you'd find that the first term, if your scale Q is this big, and that's something like 10 to the minus 5 on the Planck scale, then at the 10 to the minus 5 level, you need to work the order Q over Planck, and there are contributions involving the scalar field fluctuations which are there, and those are the calculations that people do. And the amazing thing is that those are big enough to be seen in the fluctuations in CMP. So you really have a place there where the only place that I know of where these effects are measured. Something which came up before in one of the other classes is there ever any way of getting these guys to getting some mileage of these guys? And I don't know that there's not any ways, but I've never been able to find one. Because these factors here that go along for the ride are the ones that seem to always punish you. So you're always paying a big price and you don't get to use this guy until you get D bigger than D is equal to 6. So for that, you had to go at least a third. You're not leading order, you're not next to leading order, you're next to next to leading order. And so the fact that you're next to next to leading order things are bigger than you thought they were is not so impressive. They're still suppressed by zillions of powers of Q over inflation. So maybe inflation is a place to think about here, that you're seeing the leading order, the next leading there, because you're seeing loops, so you might think, well, what extent can you see? In fact, actually, I think he said that in inflation, it's true that you can get effects which are suppressed by this mass M and not M. But they very, very rarely are doing observably interesting things. So anyway, it's good that this study is an organized way to think about how big all this is. But where I was going with that was that the only people that normally run into this as a point of practice are cosmologists. But what's often forgotten in cosmology is the analysis is almost always done in the classical approximation, and so implicit in that is that you're using this leading approximation. And so what people very rarely check is whether or not this is small. And there's some situations in inflation where this is not small, it's competing with this. And so if that's true, then you need to rethink why you're doing the classical approximation. And so that step, why the terms that you didn't write down, it's like the dog that didn't bark, right? The terms that you didn't write down in your Lagrange and then you didn't, the quantum effects you didn't calculate, implicit in your calculations that they were smaller than what you did calculate. And it's occasionally true in cosmology that they're not smaller than what you did calculate, so that really means that the conclusions that are being drawn are wrong. You really have to go back and rethink. The first thing you should ask if you're doing a classical calculation is what justifies the classical approximation? That's often not a question that's asked for that. Usually, it's something that you don't need to ask because it's you're normally way deep into the classical regime, and so it's you're nice and safe. But cosmology is one of the few exceptions. All right. So, now we have a choice as to which direction we go. But unless there's a objection, I'd like to head in the direction of various non-relativistic applications that we talked about. And so when I took the poll at the beginning of the class, things that people were most interested in were Casimir effects and boundaries, or no, this is what to do when the environment's not in its ground state. And then the generic Fermi liquids, the whole vector field linear for a Fermi surface. So to set that up, what I was going to do was start off with the logic of integrating on the end particles. So what is the, in the case that you understand what's going on, how do you see the non-relativistic limits emerge? So there's always several ways to think about effective field theories, depending on, and it normally divides along whether or not you know what the underlying theory is or not. And so, and that's true in the non-relativistic case as well. So it could be that your underlying theory is, in principle, you know what it is, it's quantum electrodynamics, but it's some complicated dense matter system that you can't predict in detail the consequences of. But there's also simpler situations like eumonium or something where there's some simple system where the dynamics is simple and just following you just happen to be in a non-relativistic regime. And so I want to start with that second case where you imagine that you have a relativistic system and you try and just integrate out the positron to see what happens. So you integrate out the antiparticles just to see what you get. And that'll kind of set up how the calculation principle could have been done if you had been doing it from first principle. But then once you kind of start seeing what the kinds of terms are that you're getting, then it also becomes easy to say, well, so what's the most general thing I could have written down? And just put an arbitrary coefficient and later on ask what those coefficients would be. So to start off with, maybe the simplest thing to start out with is I'm divided because I've got a set of notes into scalars and a set of notes into experiments. materials in its transmission. No, let me do the scanners first because they're as simple as this is more straightforward. And then I'll tell you how the permanent work. And then you'll see that what I'm about to do is what you would have called in the old days a fully Wolfhausen transformation if you're doing fermions. And it's just it's a way of making the non-relativistic limit more manifest if you're using QED. So think about this. Let's take a master scalar. And let's couple with gravity just to start things off. Just off something final, I'll just follow what it's called like here. So it's that's exactly the workout here. So our Lagrangian will be minus 3g. I want this, I'm interested in the case that the scalar field is massive, and I want it to be stable, because I don't want it to decay. And so let me give it a conserved charge complex, because that's going to be something which I'm going to be interested in for fermions, too. I want to follow the charges. So we have and I'll mention that we're looking at that our metric is, since it's going to be slowly moving, I'm going to pick up the, we're going to be interested in a Hamiltonian limit for gravity too, so I'm using that to be minus 1 plus something. Squared with a possibly a space time piece. So that's how I'm going to split up space and time. So this is the thing that would have been the, probably the two here. And what I'm interested in is in energies that are low. And the problem is that this pi, when we normally write it, it's this sort of fencing chord. It's like the integral d3p over p pi fourth times the normalization factors. We normally have both a positive and negative frequency piece. And it's silly to keep this around. Because if we're at low energies, if we had any particles, they would have annihilated the particles. And I guess I call everything phi, which is not a good thing. That's probably. So the reason I'm kind of. Laboring about the space-time split was there was that I want to follow the momentum and the energy separately, or the space and time separately. So before I do that, I should let me so that I was about to say something here about it. So we're going over the antiparticles, the heat particles, and so remember the rules for effective field theory were we were distinguishing state, space, and our energy. But we had the option, and the virtue of that was that if we exclude things on the basis of energy, then if we start off with low energies, we never get particles of higher energy because energy conservation fits that. So a variation of the theme was we were also allowed to choose, if we have any other conserved charge in the problem, we can choose to focus on low energy states in a given of a given charge if there's a charge that's conserved, because if we do that, then we're going to be guaranteed that if we start off in that sector, we never get particles that are not in that sector because of the conservation of charge as well as the energy. And so the case where you're following, in an atom or something like that, it's always true that if you think of the QED as your system and you're following the electron in an atom, then if you're asking what the ground state is in that system, the ground state is always vacuum, right? You have an atom. And so the thing that will force you to think about the ground state, the low energy limit being the one involving atoms, will be will choose the ground state, choose the low energy states, but in a sector which has, say, baryon number one and lepton number one. And that'll be the one that has hydrogen atom in it. And then the ground state of that will be the atom state. And so, because of that, I want to follow, that's why I wanted this thing to be, this quick one, I want to have a conserved charge, so I can follow that conserved charge around. So let me write down the conserved current for this conserved charge.
The conserved current, in this case, is,
and I want to keep that around because a proxy for the number of particles will be that current. And what I'm really going to do is follow the baryon number one sector. And in a relativistic theory, that could have included a baryon, you know, two baryons and an anti-baryon, three baryons and two anti-baryons. But in the nuclear energy, that's going to be the thing that tells us we're just talking about a specific number of particles with no anti-particles. But it's only when we're, these energies are less than the mass that we're allowed to start differentiating between the particles and the anti-particles. So now the problem will be in low energy is that if you think about time dependence in these modes here, that, you know, if you think of the V and the I and the X and X. So first, what was T of X? T of X was minus the energy times time plus the momentum given in its last place. And so the energy was the square root of m squared plus p squared. And so that's m plus p squared over 2m and so on. One problem will be the low energy limit for these guys, for the particles, won't be low energies compared to m. The low energy limit is always going to be m, because that's the minimum energy. There's always the rest mass of the particle is tied up in the particle. And we're able to have a low energy theory and sensibly talk about an atom with energies, kinetic energies, are small compared to m. But that's only because in that theory, we can't liberate the energy that's in the mass of this particle. And so what's going to be useful to make this, what we want to do is we want to set up identify the variables that are going to be useful ones to follow in the low energy theory. And what I'm setting up here is I want to do a redefinition of fields, which is going to get rid of this explicit M dependence everywhere. We're going to be interested in slowly, what we're going to want to do is a derivative expansion. We're going to want to expand in powers of time derivatives and space derivatives. And we want to suppress those time derivatives and space derivatives compared to M. And at face value, we're going to have trouble because time derivatives of these fields are going to bring down powers that are m or higher. And so it looks like it's going to be hard to make a sensible time derivative expansion because of the mass, the energy that's applied to the rest of the particle. And so the thought of this exercise is that there's a field projection I can do which will take care of that. So what I want to do is I just want to basically, I want to extract. There's a phase, e to minus I m t, which is going along for the ride and not doing anything interesting because it sits in here, but I can never access that energy. So if I look at the phase of a state, everything's involving, every state in the problem has an overall phase, which is e to the minus I and t. And what I'm really interested in is the small changes to that phase. And I'm interested in that phase itself because it's something that's going to drop out of making a physical interest. Because every state has the same phase because we can't change that mass. So the redefinition I want to do is this one. Let me write. The goal is just to remove fast phase like I and T from fields by that. And organize the effective field theory in powers of derivatives divided by the mass and the particular time derivatives. So to do that, what I'll do is I'll find a new field, which I'll call the same thing both here. Hi. 5 would be some normalization factor, which I'll come back to. And E minus I M T I. So this is the fact that, so that means that because phi had this common phase, E minus I and K, then I just defined it away. So that this common factor just dropped out of everything I can do. Because energy conservation will force all these energies to, the energies beforehand and the energies afterwards have to add up. And the mass of adding up will come along for free. So that's just going to drop me out. So if I follow this field phi as being the thing whose dynamics I want to keep track of, the time evolution of chi won't have this big phase that's in phi. And the F is here because when I get a kinetic term, starting from this run here, I want to get a kinetic term for chi, and I want to have F as a freedom, I want to choose F to make the leading conjugate of chi have a 1 up front here. In the same way that in the relativistic case, I've been choosing this coefficient to be 1 for complex fields and 1 half for real fields. And that was the choice of how I scale the fields. In the non-realistic case, I want to have one conjugate of like phi star conjugate of phi. I want this coefficient to be 1. And I may have to rescale the field to make that true. And that's what F is designed to do. And it's going to turn out that F is the portion of 1 over the... So F is there to allow to make chi star T I term unit coefficient. And, so that's going to turn out that F equals like 1 over the square root of twice the mass. So when we're counting powers of mass, that F will be important because it's going to carry powers of mass. And so before I dive into this, you know, the thing is, this is probably a good place to stop because once I start this next step, I could probably do like halfway through the first term. But it's kind of one of these places that I don't think you're going to be hard to get back out of it. So maybe what I should do is I'll stop here. So don't come back in the afternoon or next week. When you come back, don't come back here. And then we'll have the full 3 hours to follow me, and I'll round this out, and I'll do the effective field theory of the Fermi surface. And that'll probably take full time. At the time, I'll do the last thing with the field theory of the system of airspace. And also, the assignment, I'm going to print that over at lunchtime. So I'll get that email to you later today. So whoever has that list of email addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And I know